Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. Here in the internet age, we might wonder, are democratic ideals and technological innovations compatible? Most of us leave a wide digital trail in the wake of our day-to-day activities. Organizations and governmental agencies have a keen interest in following where that trail leads. This episode of Speakers Forum explores how surveillance and newly emerging technologies affect our civil liberties and shape our lives. The How Technology Impacts Civil Liberties event took place at Town Hall Seattle on July 14, 2015. It was sponsored by Town Hall and the Center for Democracy and Technology. The CDT works to protect online civil liberties while supporting policies that keep the internet open, innovative, and free. Former U.S. Attorney Jenny Durkan moderated the panel. She was joined on stage by Nuala O'Connor, the president of the Center for Democracy and Technology, and a former lead privacy lawyer for Amazon. Raquel Russell, the director of government relations and public affairs for Zillow, and Ryan Kahlo, the faculty director of the University of Washington's Tech Policy Lab. Thanks to Anna Tatasheff for our recording. Here, Center for Democracy and Technology board member Ira Rubenstein introduces the panel.
Good evening. As you just heard, my name is Ira Rubenstein. It's my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's town hall event. The topic of tonight's discussion is how technology impacts civil liberties. It's a topic that I tackle in my own work at NYU Law School and in my role as a member of the board of directors of CDT. As Neil Richards observes in his recent book entitled Intellectual Privacy, our most basic civil liberty is the freedom of thought, that is, the freedom to explore, investigate, ponder, read about, and talk about, write about new ideas, including ideas that are unpopular or controversial. Freedom of thought is at the core of our civil liberties, and without it, there's little substance to other cherished liberties, not only freedom of speech, but also the right to vote, to associate, to assemble and protest, and to otherwise influence public opinion and government decision-making. Technology has an obvious impact on the freedom of thought. Where once we relied mainly upon ourselves and a small circle of acquaintances to try out new ideas, now we're hard-pressed to imagine intellectual activity of any kind that does not depend on the use of the internet, large databases, search engines, ebook readers, social media, cloud computing, mobile devices and apps, the list goes on. In light of these and other new technologies, we clearly need open public discourse on how technology impacts our daily lives and our civil liberties. I'd like to thank Town Hall Seattle for including this topic on their impressive and expansive slate of civic issues. It's a model I'd love to see in more cities across America. The Center for Democracy and Technology is a perfect partner for Town Hall in this endeavor. CDT, in my completely unbiased opinion as a board member, is the leading American nonprofit advocacy organization translating our democratic values for the digital age. You'll get a chance to hear tonight from CDT's president, Nuala O'Connor, and what most impresses me about Nuala is her ability to find workable solutions in the highly partisan and often combative policy landscape of Washington, D.C. Nuala and CDT recognize that policy requires genuine civic discourse and that this discourse must include citizens, the government, and the business sector. Before I introduce your moderator for tonight and turn the program over to our incredibly distinguished group of panelists, I want to very briefly address one issue that I believe is among the most important as we consider the impact of technology on our core civil liberties, and that is the issue of voter privacy. It is now commonplace for political campaigns to assemble and maintain extraordinarily detailed dossiers on every American voter. These political dossiers contain hundreds and even thousands of data points. Not surprisingly, some of this information is derived from voter registration records, but campaigns also buy reams of personal data from commercial databases. And campaign websites and social media channels use cookies and other commercial tracking methods to profile their supporters. Did you know that in the last presidential election, both campaigns hired marketing firms to help them match cookie pools, in other words, a database of active and targetable cookies, with political dossiers in order to identify the most persuadable voters and send them targeted ads anywhere they might show up on the web, or that the Obama technical team developed a social outreach program known as targeted sharing that matched political data with Facebook profiles so that Obama supporters could persuade their friends to vote for Obama. The jury is still out on whether these techniques are effective, but many Americans might be shocked to learn how candidates target them without their knowledge or consent. In my own work, I've raised two fundamental questions about these data-driven campaign practices. First, does this relentless profiling and micro-targeting of American voters invade their personal privacy? Second, how does these new practices affect democracy? Many political theorists have observed that privacy, understood as a legally protected zone or preserve in which individuals can think their own thoughts, have their own secrets, live their own lives, and reveal only what they want to the outside world, is vital to the working of the democratic process. So what happens to democracy when campaigns routinely invade this zone by subjecting voters to a form of political surveillance in which their beliefs and preferences are monitored and tracked? This is just one of many profound questions we need to address in thinking about the implications of new technologies for our most fundamental civil liberties. I can name other troubling issues that we should also consider, ranging from discriminatory credit, insurance, and hiring practices premised on the surreptitious collection of data and the use of data analytics, to so-called predictive policing. With the Bow 2 Minority Report, police departments now identify and stop suspects based less on specific information and observation about individual conduct at a particular time and place, and more on algorithms that reveal patterns of imminent or future criminal conduct. But I will leave it to tonight's panel to take this discussion forward. It is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's moderator, Jenny Durkin, and I'll also ask the panel to come up and be seated while I complete the introductions. Jenny Durkin, a Washington native and a graduate of UW Law School, served as the United States Attorney for the Western District of Washington from October 2009 through September 2014. In this role, Ms. Durkin was the Chief Federal Law Enforcement Officer for Western Washington, responsible for civil litigation and criminal prosecutions, as well as coordination of various federal investigative agencies. She also chaired key Department of Justice committees and work groups charged with crafting national policies and investigative strategies for cybercrime, intellectual property enforcement, and consumer privacy. Her leadership for the DOJ on these fronts include testifying before Congress on national cyber issues. Since leaving this post, Jenny has continued to practice law as a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Quinn Emanuel. Please join me in welcoming Jenny Durkin.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Ira, for the great introduction, but mostly for your leadership in this space. You really have been a true leader nationally on many of these issues, and we're not going to be tracking you all night, just most of the night. What a great pleasure it is to be here at Town Hall. I think this is one of the best forums we have in Seattle for this kind of event, for people to come together and talk about what matters to them. And I couldn't be more honored to have been asked to moderate this forum on what I think is probably one of the most critical issues we face as a society. I think that the intersection of technology in all parts of our lives is going to raise fundamental questions about what role privacy plays in our lives and what is important to protect. And I can't think of a better panel to do this with. To my immediate right is Ryan Callow. Many of you probably know him. Ryan is a professor at the University of Washington Law School. He comes by way of Stanford and is probably one of the leading people in the areas of privacy, but also in robotics, and in just an exceptional thought thinker. When I was U.S. attorney and I wanted to turn to who the people I looked to in the academia to kind of figure out some of those complicated questions, I would regularly have Ryan on my speed dial. So, Ryan, thank you for being here. And we are really lucky to have Raquel Russell, not just on this panel, but to be a recent relocator to Seattle, Washington, from the other Washington. She did a sojourn in Washington, D.C., and was one of the critical people in President Obama's domestic policy shop, really focusing on urban issues. And when I had the good fortune to travel back and forth between Seattle and D.C. and DOJ, whenever there was an issue related to some of these, people would say, you know, there's this woman in the White House who could really help you. She relocated to Seattle and is now at Zillow, and we are really fortunate to have her because she really can look at the policy implications around these issues. And the woman who we could spend a lot of time introducing, Nuala O'Connor, has accomplished so much, and you would think she's got to be 80. she has really crafted. She's now president and CEO of CDT, and I think is really taking it to the next natural iteration to be a real thought leader and one of those places where all people can sit at the table and decide what's the right and policy initiatives to undertake in these areas. She's got great experience at one of our great companies here, Amazon, and worked at GE, and she took her experience from that sector and applied it, worked with also the Department of Homeland Security, so she has seen the range of issues. CDT is just, it really is one of those places that I was on a number of interagency panels in Washington, and we're trying to decide how do we broker some of these tough issues in terms of what technology should have in terms of the ability for government to, you know, intercept it and the like. It would be, no one could even talk to each other sometimes on these issues. And CDT plays just a critical role in letting people broker some of those things, but having a real vision of the importance of technology in life. So Nuala, thank you for being here. So we're going to, hopefully this will be kind of a conversation style, but we're going to kick it off. I'm going to be asking different questions, bouncing back and forth. We're going to reserve some time at the end to take questions from the audience. We thank you for being here. We know it's warm here tonight, and we really hope it'll be a fun thing. So one of the first things, you know, it's not Jeopardy. I don't get to have the music, but we will do first a lightning round. So I'm going to ask each of the panelists to name what they think is the most exciting new technology and then also to say whether they think the biggest threat to privacy is coming from government or from private enterprise. So Ryan, let's start with what's the most exciting new technology?
Well, you wouldn't be surprised to hear that I think that robotics is the most exciting new technology. I understand, shock me. I'll just give you briefly my reason for that. So if you think about the current transformative technology of our time, the internet, right? And you think about how the internet came to be so dominant, you know, think of its history. There was the ARPANET, which was a U.S. military initiative that ended up funding the initial internet, and then it was a public-private partnership with and so forth. And now that very same group of people have moved over from ARPA to DARPA and are investing very, very heavily in robotics. And so I think that we're on this initial curve. I think a lot of companies, too, are agreeing with me right now.
Raquel, how about you?
So I don't know if I could pick a specific technology, but I think the thing that I'm fascinated by is just the quick advancement of social media generally. I mean, Facebook feels like it just started, you know, a year ago, a blink of an eye, and now we have Snapchat and Periscope, and just the way that the newer generations are using these social media platforms to connect, I think is just a fascinating thing, and it's happening so quickly at such lightning speed, it's kind of hard to keep track of.
Nuala.
So at CDT, we're interested in technology in your daily life, and I'm going to pick not only a technology but an actual device. I'm, as a single working mother of three young children, my hands are literally and figuratively full. I was in the kitchen the other day, and I wanted to set a timer for something I was cooking, and I had goop all over my hands, and I thought, you know what I really need? I really need my Amazon Echo. Who's got an Amazon Echo? Thank you very much. And again, I should say, in my completely unbiased opinion, as Ira said about CDT, I have a little bias having worked on the product when I was there. But it is your, you know, it's the kernel of your Star Trek computer for your house. If anyone is a big Star Trek fan, as I am, that is our vision. You know, my vision for technology is a positive one, that we will move towards a world of equality and integration and a tolerance, fueled and supported by technology that supports democratic values. But on a more literal level, I love this device. It's got a great home manager. It can tell me anything. It talks to me. At least there's someone at home who will listen to me now, which has never happened before, right? So I'm a big fan, and I commend to you the privacy policies. I had a little something to do with those as well.
That's great. I will say, I think the thing that has changed my life most recently is the Starbucks app, where you can order it and just go pick it up. It's critical to survival. I'm going to skip. I said I'd talk about the government versus things, but let's first talk. What do you think, Nuala, we're going to start at the end. What is, in your mind, the biggest single thing, and this is lightning round, so you got to do more later. What has the biggest potential to erode our policy, our privacy, without us knowing it?
And you mean any device, technology, anything? Well, it's the creeping intrusion or presumption that all of your data should be easily accessible by your government, whatever government that is, state, local, federal. The sense, again, I've worked on this issue of the digital self, that one has boundaries. There are boundaries between you and the other, you and your family, you and your institutions, religious, educational, governmental. And I believe we have gone too far in the balance of power between the self and the state. And so my biggest concern, and yes, we have real concerns about governments and companies, and we can talk all about them, but I believe that this eroding of the sense of a clear boundary around my digital self in relationship to my government is very concerning to me. And if you look at the history of, again, of list making and of governments kind of knowing who you are and where you are and what you're thinking, I love the reference to Neil Richards' work. I need to have a safe and sacred space, and that includes my space online, where I'm free to think and associate and express myself without assuming that that will all end up in the hands of the government.
Raquel, what do you think?
So I'm going to piggyback on that a little bit and just tweak it some. For me, I think it kind of ties back to my first response around social media, is the culture shift that's happening of what is okay to be shared and what is not okay to be shared. You know, everyone's baseline of privacy is constantly shifting, and it's shifting at a very high rate at this point. And so to me, I think that, you know, as that baseline shift, will policies be able to keep up with that cultural shift?
Right.
Mine's much more pedestrian. I actually think that facial recognition changes everything. I mean, I don't know if you guys noticed, but I took a flash photo of you, and I apologize for that. It was a terrible thing to do. And I'm going to tweet it later, and I'm going to say, you know, I went really well at the town hall. And then if you think about the fact that now Facebook has technology that can recognize your face, even if it's obscured, suddenly now, whether it's the corporation or it's the government or whatever it happens to be, can scour the entire internet and maybe also private databases and just find you where you are, even if you yourself did not upload anything, even if you took pains to obscure your face. And so I think that's a real sea change, and I think that facial recognition is a big, big deal. I know something that CDT's worked on quite a lot.
That's great. Good segue to the last question of the lightning round until we do a final lightning round at the end. Is, you know, we talk about, and I think Nuala is very, really important about the surrender of self to government and what's that balance. I was on a panel once with Brad Smith, and I gave him, it was when I was still a United States attorney, and I said, look, Brad, you just want us to have to buy it from you. So what's the bigger threat, really, to personal privacy? Is it the information that government is collecting, or is the information that every device you collect, which gets aggregated, the larger threat right now? Brian, I'm going to start with you.
I think that the classic arguments for why it's the government is the bigger threat are two. One is that the government has a monopoly on violence. Right? I mean, no matter what Facebook might do to you, turns out they can't really throw you in jail, and they certainly can't kill you. And so the question then, you know, but I wonder if that's, at the end of the day, really not disingenuous, but is it a full enough answer, right? Because corporations can make decisions that affect your lives in incremental ways, shorten lifespans, and pollute, and all kinds of other things. And so, you know, it's conceivable. The second argument you always hear is that at least with corporations, you understand their incentives. Like, they just want to make money. Whereas the government has sort of mercurial kind of mixed incentives, and you're not totally sure how they're going to do things, and maybe they're going to do things differently in a new regime. And so those are usually the arguments. I actually personally don't know which is the greater threat.
Well, I will say selfishly, as someone who was a government employee for over 10 years, and with the data breach that just recently happened for many government employees, I would have to say the government. I mean, it's really scary to think. I mean, they have so much information on me personally, given the jobs I had and the information I had to provide in order to get those jobs. And, you know, for all those government employees whose information was stolen, I mean, that's a scary thing.
So now I am going to show my age at 85 and say, you know, I've been chief privacy officer at 2 federal agencies and 3 major companies that I can remember right now. And the answer, without a doubt to me, is the federal government. But let me tell you why. And I think you're right, Ryan. We've all talked about it for a long time. I was doing some deeper thinking knowing you were going to ask this question earlier today. And the answer, I mean, the flippant answer I always give is, well, because the government can put you in jail, as Ryan points out, because of the monopoly on violence and the deprivation of rights and liberty. And assets and access to services, et cetera, and that your recourse in voting against a government activity on data or privacy is to vote with your feet and change countries, which to me seems like a very draconian, you know, response to that sort of thing. Your answer in voting against a particular company practice is to not do business with that company. But there's another answer as well, which I hadn't thought of before, and that is, company, and this is not to let the companies off the hook. Good companies are doing hard work on this issue. Lots of companies are not. And the answer to that is, and there's a government backstop. So when there is an outlier or misbehavior by a company, there is the FTC in this country. There are the state's attorney generals. I was on the receiving end in a year and a half, a double click of 12 attorney general investigations, 21 class actions, and an FTC investigation for a data merger that actually never happened. So I'm pretty confident that we have good enforcement in this country, and I certainly know well the laws in the rest of the world. So there's not only company and kind of market forces and customer distrust or, you know, concern, but then there's government backstops and legal action that can be taken to protest a company, a behavior. But again, I really do go to the deprivation of rights and liberties. That is not to say that, to minimize, you're absolutely right, Ryan, the opportunity for hidden decision-making and opportunity cost and loss by a consumer not knowing about data that is presented to them or information that's presented to them is very real, and those are some of the issues we're working on at CDT.
Ryan, you want to add something?
Just add something by way of support. So another thing you have to remember is that companies can make promises to you that about your privacy. They're not going to do X, Y, and Z, right? And if they do X, Y, and Z that they said they wouldn't, then the Federal Trade Commission or someone else can come in and enforce it. If X, Y, or Z, however, is we're not going to give the money to, we're not going to give your information to the government, which some companies say, like we're going to push back, we're not going to give the, if they don't do that, right? If they don't fulfill that promise, the government's not going to police against it. You know what I mean? And so it's like,
yeah,
the exactly. They're going to be like, I guess, well, you know, give it to the DOJ, it's fine. You know what I mean? Like the FTC is not going to enforce a promise by a company against itself, essentially, right? And so that's another, it's just adding a little bit of
And just to build on that, you can say we're going to be in violent agreement all night long. I'm sorry about that. We should mix it up a little bit, and we probably will. But the opportunity for an individual to correct that wrong or to complain about that, it's very, very hard to make that case to the government, as you point out, when they've got the data and it's not known and not transparent. I also was a victim of the OPM breach, as many of us were. And that is why, to me, the compelling public policy issue in the internet space is the one of government data collection, because it impacts both your relationship directly to the government and your relationship directly to the companies. And it's the bleeding or the blurring of the line, the potential lack of clarity or lack of boundaries between private sector data sets that were collected mostly with your knowledge. And that would be a big, you know, big theme, I would say, in our direct-to-company advocacy is transparency, accountability, you know, data minimization, knowing what you're collecting and is it relevant to your relationship to the company. But it's the blurring of the lines that really erodes trust in not only the government but the companies as well. And so that issue of government data collection erodes the whole ecosystem of the internet and trust in my ability, again, not only to transact with companies but to speak my mind.
You know, I'm gonna moderate and jump in a little bit. You know, I think that when I was U.S. attorney, you know, so for 5 years I was the chief federal law enforcement officer, and obviously government used its powers it could to collect information in the criminal setting. I won't talk about the national security setting. I really believe that the generation coming up is different, as Raquel says, from my generation in a number of ways and for a number of reasons. But I think that they are being conditioned from every angle to not care about privacy and to think privacy doesn't matter. And I actually think that that is due mostly to the monetization of the lack of privacy. And that's where I think maybe it's not the actual collection of privacy, although we'll talk about that later, that I think there are a lot of dangers. But it's the constant mantra of privacy doesn't matter. And, you know, we're going to talk about this in a little bit, but I think everyone sitting in this panel knows people don't read the privacy policies before they click I agree. People don't know how their information is being used. It's not transparent. And so I think that educated person, you know, it's from the days of, right, you know, in the 50s when there were contracts of adhesion, and they changed it, you know, you can't have the small print. So I think we're going to see an evolution of that as well. Government has to be circumscribed. That's in our Constitution. It's part of who we are. I think we always have to fight that battle. But I think we also have to keep an eye on, you know, what is private industry doing? What can they do and what should they do? So we've talked a lot about interconnectedness. You know, you drive up to a toll booth, you've got your automatic pass, you drive across the 520 bridge, it automatically sends something, then it automatically sends to your bank. Everything is connected. It is more difficult to do things today to not leave a digital trace. And so a segue is, you know, do consumers really understand what information is being collected about them? Nuala.
No, and I never want to be the voice on any panel that says, you know, the consumer is not knowledgeable or whatever. I think it's almost hard to keep up with the level of technological advancement. But I am the more hopeful. I'm still, despite what I've seen both in government and in the private sector, I'm still the most hopeful voice on this panel, I think, for a number of reasons. I believe greatly. Actually, there are good people both in the government and the private sector who are trying to get this right. I believe there are good companies that, when simply sparking the dialogue about customer expectation and customer trust, are doing the right thing, are trying to get this right. I agree with your point about privacy policies completely. Having written more of them than anybody in this room, right? I am the Mark Twain or the Faulkner, or I don't know what author of privacy policies that no one's ever read. That's no longer the way. But this is not to say privacy is dead, or that the fair information practice principles and the tenets that we've espoused in this country and others are dead. But rather, they need to be reworked and reimagined for the digital age, for the always-on age, for the internet of everything and everywhere. And I'm going to go back to my Amazon Echo example, because I'm so proud of the Echo. Again, having worked a little
She's
bit on it,
really
I'm really excited. And can you tell?
My
only disappointment for Amazon people in the room is that I can't name it. The only choices are Alexa or Amazon. But nevertheless, like, I want to call it anyway something inappropriate for this audience, right? I want to have it a name, like, you know, my personal assistant. Anyway, but that device has privacy protections not only built into the hardware and software of the programming, but literally in the device. It lights up when it's listening. It circles when it's actually actively listening and collecting data. There are other ways to signify. I'm very much into the kind of the nonverbal cues. Look at the airport signs that say baggage. I was just pointing this out to my five-year-old as I left the Washington, D.C. airport yesterday. He can't quite read yet, but he can read the sign that says airplane or luggage or whatever. The same rules apply in the internet, the embedded internet, the connected world. We can no longer rely on 14-page privacy policies stuck in the back of a website or in those papers that you get from your bank in the mail once a year. I mean, really, does anybody read those? I've written those too, by the way, early in my career. Nobody reads them. I don't even read them. But having visual cues, having embedded in the technology, in the device, I mean, these are exciting opportunities. And let me just pause and say, we need to talk about that age thing, because I do not agree with the conventional wisdom that the young people today don't care about privacy. So I'm going to just cue you on that.
So I'm going to jump on that and say that I completely agree with that last statement you made, Nuala. I think that people and consumers do know the data that is being, you know, that they're giving up. I mean, how can you not? When you're on Gmail, you get targeted advertising based on an email you sent, like, you know, 4 hours ago. I mean, like, so you know that there's data being collected and you know it's being used. And maybe we don't know the extent of it as the average consumer, but I think we do know. And I think that for many consumers, especially the younger generations, including myself, you know, we weigh the pros and cons. And the ease that technology brings to my life outweighs the fact that, like, you're collecting some data on me. And that's just the facts. I mean, that's the facts for myself and for many of my friends and my peers, is that the ease that those technologies bring completely outweigh the fact that, I mean, like, TurboTax is a great example. Like, I am not, like, 100% convinced, nor have I ever actually done any kind of due diligence to make sure that all that information I'm giving to TurboTax is going to be safe. But I'd rather do that than fill it out by paper and pen. So I do.
Ryan, what do you think?
I mean, I get beat up a lot on the question of whether notice works, like privacy disclosures. So I wrote a paper a few years ago that's called Against Notice Skepticism in Privacy and Elsewhere, in which I say that...
Look, that's the short version of the title.
That's the short version of the title. There's a colon and then... But and I argue that we should be doing more of what Nuala said, which is more what I call visceral or experiential notice, where it's built into the very product, like apparently it is in Echo. And I think there's a lot of opportunity for that. I also think that there's a lot of opportunity to have a privacy disclosure for the more sophisticated entity that is actually very full. So for the CDTs, for the FTC, for the journalist, and then have more visceral notice for the. So I think we should be kind of tracking to track notice. But I will say that at the end of the day, and I hope we talk about this more, it's really about asymmetry. You know, it's about the fact that the company knows an unbelievable amount about you, and you don't know hardly anything really about them. And in fact, there's not only an information asymmetry, but there's an asymmetry about the asymmetry. That is to say, they know that they know a lot more than you, and you can't even begin to scope how much more they know about you, right? And that asymmetry matters. And I want to talk more about that. I'm similarly sort of hopeful about the potential of smart design to convey information.
And how much do we leave to market, and how much do we step in and have laws? I mean, I think that's always a balanced tension, but at what point should consumers have some absolute right to know, for example, what has been collected, what's been aggregated, to be able to look at it, and to be able to edit it? What do you think, Ryan?
Well, I mean, I certainly agree with Commissioner Brill at the Federal Trade Commission that consumers should have much more access and understanding to their information in the hands of data brokers. And I totally commend you to her speeches about the Reclaim Your Name initiative. And she's sort of using a mixture of her position as a regulator with a megaphone, but also sort of hinting at the idea that if we don't get these kinds of ability to access and correct and so forth your data, that perhaps at some point the Federal Trade Commission will come along and do something about it. In other words, a lot, I think, of a competition around privacy happens against the backdrop of the threat of regulation. So it's very difficult to say precisely what the effect of regulation is, because it's both the actual acts of regulation, the people get slapped on the wrist, and it's also the possibility of that and the backdrop of that, and the people who have regulatory authority who in turn have soft power because of that regulatory authority. That didn't at all answer your question, but I'm glad I said it.
We're here to talk, not answer questions.
I'm glad I said it. So I do think there needs to be checks and balances. I don't know that we can rely solely on government. I think that, and I think Nuala and Jenny would agree with me here, government does not move as fast as technology. And so if we rely on government to create policies in order to protect our privacy, especially in the technology space, I just don't see how that works and that aligns and jives. The technology is constantly changing and I just don't see how policies would be able to keep up with that to the full degree. And so I don't know that we can rely wholly on policy and government in order to protect our privacy. I'm a believer, and maybe it's the idealist in me, that education is key in this, right? And I think that we may educate consumers on the privacy, the data that is being collected on them, and what we would maybe consider the privacy infringements, and they may choose to be like, that's okay. And I think that to some degree that the market will have to kind of play that role in it. I mean, I think there's going to be some checks and balances there, and I don't think that all consumers are going to be as concerned with some of the conversation that we're having today and the issues that we're talking about today. But I do think that education to the consumers is going to be really important.
So education can, just to understand you correctly, so education can keep up with technology, but law can't.
I mean, I don't see how government can. I mean, I'm not sure that anything can keep up with technology. I mean, I'm only 6 months into working in the technology sector, but to say that things move at lightning speed compared to how things move in the government is an understatement.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And so I just don't know how government alone and policies alone can keep up with the pace of technology.
Education of the consumer by the companies deploying new technologies is the new concept I'm kind of working through is the idea of corporate social responsibility and corporate social responsibility in the digital world means the responsible use of data, the responsible use of information as part of the transaction with the customer. And I saw this first at DoubleClick again in the dark ages before any of you were born, apparently, in the early, before the first dot-com bust.
It was single-click.
So yeah. Long, right, exactly. There was dial-up modems when I first started. And I remember saying that in kind of our senior leadership, who had gotten themselves into some serious hot water on the issue of cookies and the potential merger of an offline and online data space. Again, that didn't happen because the offline data was on punch cards, and really there was just no way to match them. But I said, guys, I know you all get what a cookie is and what this, tracking looks like, and that it's really fairly benign because you're trying to serve people ads about like tennis shoes when they were on the Sports Illustrated site, which is not that different than serving a contextual ad in a magazine. But this freaks people out. Candidly, my professional legal opinion is there's fear and loathing of the technology. And if you want to be the promoter and the promulgator of a new technology, you have to not only think about how to use it responsibly, but also how to help educate the consumer so that they can make intelligent choices and informed choices about what they're doing. So I think you're right. This is not to argue for only self-regulation and education. I can make all those arguments all day long. There's absolutely need for the FTC and the attorneys general. And then I would argue, and I've come full circle on the kind of omnibus federal privacy law in this country, and that's because the market is not just this country. The market is global, right? And for a multinational of any country doing business on the internet, we need to be thoughtful about where we are in the ecosystem of privacy and data protection laws, and we are not even on the playing field as a country, right? We are considered the great unwashed in the dialogue in the rest of the world on how we treat individual customer and consumer and individual data. And so, I was just telling the story recently and was laughed at. I gave the speech at the International Commissioners Conference, 15 years ago, going through all the U.S. privacy laws. And there are a lot. There are a lot of U.S. privacy laws. There are, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act and Fair Credit Reporting Act and Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the Video Protection Act. And if you go through each one, it takes you a long time, especially if you're speaking slowly for a multinational audience. That didn't go over very well, particularly with Europeans who have one law. Right, one law, and it's a lot easier to explain. And so if you want to be on the playing field in an international dialogue with international consumers, when confronted with this ridiculous Byzantine, attorneys general and blah, 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 versus there's one law and one regulator in the country that they can go to complain, you kind of see the elegance in that, right? And so I'm not here to say the Europeans have it right, because I think there's lots and lots of laws, and the fundamental principles underlying the laws are very consonant socially. But the Latin Americans have a phrase which is essentially habeas data, my data, myself. And I really like that. To me, that speaks to my idea of the data is part of me. I choose to engage freely with this company, and so they have some rights in that data when I give it. I used to use this, forgive me, Amazon folks, I used to use this before I even worked there, which was you have to give them the address so they can deliver the book. Like, that's part of the deal, right? It's profoundly impossible to consummate that deal unless I tell you where I live so you can deliver the book. And so some data has to be transacted, but it is still my address, right? It's still where I live, and it's still a part of my data. I retain rights in that data. And I like that construct far better than U.S. property rights, that it's something I sell or trade or barter, or even, the very, very draconian kind of regulatory structure around European human rights law, which gets to, a lot of good principles, less enforcement, but it's still not mine. This is mine. It's part of me.
But I think you're right. I mean, if you look at the areas where we've tried to legislate around technology, it's by the time we get it enacted, it's already obsolete. But aren't there some fundamental principles? I go back, my first kind of entree into the privacy realm was about 19 years ago when I made the mistake of ordering a pizza, and they said, "What's your phone number?" And I said, "You don't need to call me, just bring me a pizza." And they refused to deliver the pizza unless I would give my phone number, because that's how they were going to keep the information. So I was complaining to a friend of mine who happened to be the state's attorney general at the time, who then said, "Great, you're in charge of my new consumer privacy task force." And we had meetings for over a period of a year, from the financial industry, from tech industry was barely burgeoning at that time, but we included them well, and we had a whole thing. So we drafted legislation we thought we had everyone's agreement on, and there was two parts of it. One was consumer privacy, and it was a strict opt-in. You can't collect the information unless they opt in and agree to it. And you can only collect the information they really need for that transaction, and you can only use it for that transaction, then you have to be done with it. And the second part of it was the first identity theft legislation in the country. So we dropped the bill, which is what they call when they introduce it in Olympia. Literally that day, 85 new business lobbyists registered. I'd never seen, it was amazing. And they killed the consumer privacy part of it. I can say quite happily, we did get the first identity theft bill passed and became the national model. But it showed me, even then, everyone understood that there was a way to monetize this data and to take from people and use it in ways and aggregate it in ways people didn't understand. So, you know, are there fundamental principles that people should be able to say, I will give you my address, but I only want you to use that address to send me the book. You can't use it for anything else. What do you think, Ryan?
I hear this argument you might imagine all of the time, which is the idea that technology can't, that law can't keep up with technology. And I sort of take the point. I mean, for example, by the time the Federal Aviation Administration approved a drone for testing delivery by Amazon, right? By the time they actually got the application and read it and said yes to it, Amazon had already moved on to a new technology and it was useless to them and they had to apply again. It's like this Sisyphean task, right? On the other hand, if you think about the laws that the Federal Trade Commission enforces, what they say is that you can't be unfair or deceptive. And guess what? That matters in 1982, and it matters in 2015. And you know, I mean, it's what we call a standard instead of a rule. And so I don't totally understand why the government couldn't be more responsive. I think that one issue that I will immediately concede is that the government, by and large, does not have adequate technical expertise. Right? And that's something I think you get, speaking of, violent agreement around, all around. And I think the Federal Trade Commission, for example, is trying to address that by hiring very good technologists. In fact, they just hired someone from my lab to work in the technology shop there. So that's a big problem, not having adequate understanding. I'm sure you encountered that. I'm sure each of you encountered that, right? But I don't know that the law intrinsically can't keep up in some deep sense, because we have ways of just, you know, I mean, can the Fourth Amendment keep up? You know, I mean,
I think that standard, or a general standard, can keep up. But I mean, there is an intricacy to I think the privacy policies, and those are the things that I'm not sure that government can keep up with. I think that can we create a general standard, but to say something is, you know, should be fair and just. Well, what does that mean? I mean, you know, the devil's in the details, and so that's where the concern is. But that is not to say that there should not be policies and government doesn't have a role to play. I think they absolutely do. I just don't think that we can rely wholly on the government, just given the fact of how slow the government sometimes works.
Fair enough.
Yeah, that's right. Yuli, you wanted to jump in on that.
Well, I've said recently in a speech that I despair of this Congress, for example, so that's probably where I come out. It's not so much that it couldn't be done, it's that it's moving at the glacial speed. I think, right, if we were drafting, and we are thinking about this at CDT a lot, a clean sheet of paper, what a privacy law in this country looks like, it would be very short, and it would be high-level principles, and it would not get to... A worry I have, again, for innovation and for the tech sector is once you create a particular standard around a technology or a security standard or whatever, you create a chilling effect, and you also create a target for the hackers to shoot at, right? When you say, this is what we're all going to do, then suddenly you've chilled innovation. But I think the high-level standards, and the FTC Act is the right place to point at, of fairness, of fair dealing, and then maybe with some more granularity around the information best practices and information principles that good companies, frankly, are largely already doing, would be a very short bill, and we would have all the same challenges you experienced, Jenny, of weaving through all of the many constituencies that clearly care about data. You know,
Go ahead.
Okay.
I was saying very quickly. I mean, right now, as it happens, the Federal Communications Commission is trying to decide how it's going to regulate privacy. And it has a long history of having these technology-specific, lumbering kinds of rules, you know, that are, I agree, exceedingly slow. So it needs to now decide, like, as it drags certain kinds of, I don't want to get too technical, but the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, now has an opportunity to write the privacy rules, essentially, for internet service providers. And they have a menu of options. And one of them will be this
very technically specific thing that will become outdated, or in the other will be this approach of looking to broader standards. And that, so it's a real choice that government has, and sometimes it makes the wrong choice.
Yeah. And I was struck by something that Iris said in the introduction, and how important the freedom of thought is, and thinking about technologies now. You know, where does the person who is, you know, whether you're the teen who's curious about sexually transmitted diseases, or you're a person who's struggling with alcohol or drug abuse or this, where do they go without being tracked and without leaving a record? Because, you know, maybe it goes back to that intersection between government and private companies, but, you know, try right now researching something anonymously.
They go to Mozilla Firefox.
I mean, but it, seriously, I mean, it's, I mean, what do we do for those? I mean, if you go now, if you go online, you know, even with Mozilla, there's going to be tracking of searches. On the one hand, it was very transparent of Facebook to give everyone's history and Google to say, hey, you want to sign up for the day and see all your searches? But on the other hand, you know, people sit down at the computer and have been using it a lot like a library. I want to find out about X. I want to think about X. And so they, in the search, never knowing that someone was maintaining that forever. How does that, what should we do about the ability to have that anonymity and provide to make sure that there's that ability of freedom of thought? They have no thoughts on freedom of thought.
That's a $1 million question. You answer it. And this is not a perfect answer. It's barely an answer at all. But I do think that the level of expectation is changing. I expect to be tracked. I expect someone to be collecting that data. What I also expect is that they're not going to use it against me, that they're not going to abuse that power. And so I expect them to monetize it so that, you know, there's an ad that comes up about something that I just Googled, and it comes up in the next, you know, time I open up my laptop and I open up, you know, Chrome, which is what I use, but like whatever you use, like, you know, I expect that. But I just expect it not to be used against me and to be abused. So I do think that level of expectation is changing, and it's not. And I think to some degree it's generational, but I don't think it's completely generational. I think there. I have friends who forbid to get on Gmail, for the example I used earlier. You know, I mean, I have a friend who won't even get. You know, most grocery stores give you those cards where you can save some money and you swipe it each time. She forbids to get one because they're tracking what she's buying. You know, like she is very much so, and she's same age as me, and she has made that choice, and I've made a different choice, like, right? So, you know, I don't know how you have that kind of anonymity in the information age. I don't know how you do that.
But does it hurt us as a society? I mean, because I can tell you one case where someone came to me and they were concerned about a particular governmental misconduct, and they wanted to report it, but they wanted to remain a whistleblower, anonymous. And they literally could not find a route to do it. Does that hurt us as a society?
Well, so there are tools. I mean, there's Tor. There are, in all seriousness, there are the many Mozilla tools and other smaller tools. And I've talked to folks in the privacy enhancing and security spaces, and they despair of the fact that they're not widely accepted, right? That they have, and that's because I've said to them, guys, because the interfaces are clunky and they're really hard to use, right? And so they haven't taken off, and it does reflect somewhat their own lack of kind of good UI, but also that there's not the widespread desire, right? That these are percentages on either extreme who say, give me, I don't care about, you know, anybody knowing, or I don't want anybody to know. And I think the vast majority of consumers are somewhere in the middle. But I thought Raquel's answer was perfect and beautiful. It was, I'm less concerned about the collection, which I'm still hard over on the collection side as well, but I don't want it to be used against me. And that is a beautiful and incredibly important sentiment, that it is not just the data, it is also the decision. And what we're, again, our digital decisions project at CDT is looking at the unintended disparate impact in data collection in a variety of milieu, in a variety of spaces that, again, even well-intentioned, you know, engineers and product designers might not stress test or should be stress testing new technologies, new data collections, new devices for the unintended or hidden disparate impact that may simply be not something they were thinking about when they were designing, may not be a value proposition that they were considering. But having those values, again, of equality, of democracy, of equal impact, embedded in the design stage are the way to get this right. And again, to quote the great Jeff Bezos, you know, we are still at day one of the internet. The time to build those values in is now. It is not, other many people in this space say, oh, it's too late, there's so much data out there. No. We're still in the early, early days of getting this right. But the decisions we make now will last for decades, for centuries. And so we really need to do the hard work around fairness of, and around equality, around embedding Democrat values in the embedded internet.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that's great. We were talking earlier about some of the, you know, very concrete way is because so much information has been aggregated, you know, when you log on, they can pretty much tell who you are, what you've bought, what kind of car. And the reverse is the reverse marketing, you know, trying to get you to buy stuff, trying to give you a mortgage cheaper. Were built into those algorithms could be basically, you know, digital redlining, you know? And what kind of steps do you think we can take to prevent against that?
Right. That, I mean, I think that, speaking of a $1 million question, that's so hard because it doesn't intend to be intentional in the way that, you know, we think of intentional. I mean, I cannot imagine that folks are out to redline on purpose, you know, the way that we once did. Let me say it a slightly different way. So, can you imagine that the folks at Google or Facebook would be sitting there thinking to themselves on purpose that they want to deny opportunities to people on the basis of their color or their race and things like that? You see what I mean? Like that, I don't think they're intentionally doing that. And maybe some people do it intentionally. Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, yes, right? And it's something that I think about and write about all the time. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that so much of the mischief is going to be unintentional. It's interesting you guys have a different intuition because I would like to sell it that way. You know what I mean? But I don't think it can be. I mean,
Raquel,
honestly,
what do you think?
I go back to the housing crisis and predatory lending that was happening, and I don't know how much of that was being, you know, how much data and technology was being used for the predatory lending that happened in this country, especially around communities of color. I don't know, but I can say that if they had that technology, would they use it? Sure, because they were doing it, and they weren't doing it unintentionally.
Fair enough.
So,
I mean,
you know,
fair
I mean,
enough. Gosh, I mean, that's further than I would go.
Yeah.
I mean, because I think it's already a problem.
I don't know that they were using technology or data to do that, but they were doing it intentionally. And so if they had technology at their hands that could allow them to do that, since they were doing it intentionally anyway, why wouldn't they?
Yeah, I take it back then, honestly, because from my perspective, look, from my perspective, it's like this, you know, companies do crappy things in order to make money, right? And so for example, why is it that almost any major business that you call, you don't talk to a person anymore, you just talk to some automation? They know you don't like that. You know, it just saves them money. Like, why did banks have a class action against them where what was happening was that people were making purchases on their debit card and the bank was holding back those purchases so it could make sure to trigger as many possible overdraft fees as it could. And so it was putting them in the correct order to extract much of it. Why does everything cost $9.99? Do you know what I mean? Like, so companies are always trying all the time, you know, to extract as much rent, to use the economic terminology that you might think, right? And when they're armed with an immense amount of information about you, they're going to leverage that information. So it's actually precisely what you said, which is that people who are doing bad things are now going to be doing bad things with lots of data. Right. I've always thought it's bad enough that these things are going to fall in what is known in constitutional law as a disparate impact. The idea being that even if you didn't design your test to keep people of color out of the fire department, the fact that it does is enough to look at that and say this is not what society should tolerate. But it's interesting that many of you believe that some folks are doing it on purpose, and maybe that's right. I should say maybe that's right. Excuse me.
But I'll pull it back. And this was that question was phrased differently, so he wasn't prepared for it. I'll take part of that responsibility.
No, it's your fault. I mean,
yeah. It's always the moderator's fault. But you know, let's take it back a little bit more because I think that we see already a huge digital divide between. In our country, between those who have ready access to technology and those that don't. you know, what are some of the things that we can address and learn about the importance of privacy, but at the same time make sure that there's an equal playing field there? What do you think about that, Nuala?
Well, that is the I think, fundamental question. And we look at issues of access to the internet and simply access to being online in other parts of the world as kind of the critical juncture, right? People don't have access to computers. But the reality is that's happening in our own country, right? And so I think it's that you see a lot of advocacy in this space that is somewhat, frankly, condescending to the rest of the world. The reality is there are kids in schools in this country who can't do their homework because they don't have a computer at home or they don't have internet access at home and that sort of thing. So you're right. The privacy seems like a nice to have for people who don't have the actual physical or software tools to get to the devices and the information that they need. And I think that's the threshold question. And we talk about net neutrality and we talk about other, you know, principles of open internet, but as a mom, I'm also concerned about, you know, the fairness at the earliest possible ages and reinforcing kind of discrimination by increasing that divide over time. And it has to start, I mean, digital literacy has to start at the earliest ages. So, I would love to see not only real thought about computer science and coding and curriculum and access to hardware at the earliest stages across the country, but literacy, both in how to behave online and you know, be a good consumer of information and a discerning consumer. But I really love the initiatives around coding and computer science as sciences in the curriculum in this country, because again, there's still a hierarchy of sciences that are considered adequate to be included in elementary and secondary education curriculum in this country. And I think knowing and understanding the code and being able to discern for ourselves whether there is disparate impact or we don't like the look of some particular algorithm or we know a little bit about what's behind the curtain, those are skills that kids 30 years from now are really going to need.
Yeah, I heard something really interesting from one of the founders of Code.org is that we, we all took biology, or most of us probably took biology in school. I dissected a frog and knew all along that I was never going to be a doctor, but I still had to do that, right? And kids nowadays need to learn how to code and need to learn computer science. It's too much part of our day to day. And to the issue of equality when it comes to internet access, you know, there is a lot of income inequality and a lot of inequality in this country, and I think we all know it. It is hard to get by in this country without being connected somehow to the internet. And many of us who are better off are extremely connected to the internet. Like I don't know what I would do if I left my phone at home. I would literally be lost because I'm new to Seattle, so I would actually be lost. But the fact that, you know, there are children in homes who, it's not that they just can't afford internet access, their homes are not hardwired. I mean, they literally cannot get internet access into their homes even if they could afford it. That just shouldn't be in a country, you know, where the information age is king, period.
The other thing I think we can say with pretty good confidence is that technologies are vetted as against the mainstream population. And it's very rare that technology will be vetted as against a non-mainstream population. And so one of the things that my lab does, and this is at the direction of Batya Friedman, one of my co-PIs, co-directors, is that we actually have created panels of people that are not non-mainstream in order to do analyses of various technologies that we look at. So, for instance, we will look at gender, we will look at disability, and the panels will be people who are disabled, who study disability. One recent panel that we did was on people who have had contact with the prison system. And so what we see is that the definition of technology, its utility, some of the other contours of it actually change, sometimes kind of dramatically. I can give you just one quick example of that, which is that augmented reality, the idea that there will be like a layer of reality over what you see, and we think of it as being, I thought of it as being augmented, so more reality. And so I'd never thought of it being a problem if you were to maybe shut off augmented reality like Google Glass or something like that. When you were in a bathroom or in a boardroom, right? But when we talked to people with disabilities, they were actually using augmented reality as a substitute, for a sense, that they didn't have.
And so it would be deeply problematic to turn it off automatically in a boardroom or a bathroom. And that's an insight that we just simply would not have realized had we not done that. And so I think that that's another layer, too, is like, can we really vet our technology that way?
And this gets to some of the, not only the pipeline issues at the earliest stages, but the pipeline issues in the tech industry. And we're debating, and we're having lots of conversations in the technology community about diversity on panels, diversity in the development stage. And you see devices when they are created by a perhaps non-diverse segment not actually literally working and serving customers. I mean, this is not a profound aha moment. You know, marketing in the 1960s in the United States realized that the consumers were largely women who were buying packaged goods, and they started putting women on the team because they could speak better to the customer. This is the same principle, right? We in tech always think we invented everything, right? We didn't actually invent some of these issues. We may be better at creating them or hopefully solving them. But I think I'd hate to call out a particular device, but I think it was Oculus that literally did not work because is it augmented reality? It's a visual viewer.
According to Dana Boyd, it made women nauseous.
Right, because because literally the viewfinder was actually set at a width that did not work for almost every woman's eyes, and it was not tested on any women, and that probably reflects the fact that there were probably no women on the design team, right? And so I'm a big believer in and there's all sorts of studies. I mean, Harvard Business School Review has done this study over and over again: women on boards and women in leadership and blah blah blah. But women on design teams for the technology will better serve the result, right? And so that's just one example of a kind of diversity. But diversity in the pipeline in creating the device, I think, will end up with better devices and hardware and software in the future.
That's great. All right, we're getting close to Q&A time. Two more lightning rounds at the end, and then we'll take some questions from the audience. Lightning round question. So the Europeans, as Nuala has mentioned it, EU has a very different approach to privacy, and it's much more privacy-centric, and including, I don't know if people know that there was a recent case from the court over there that found that people have the right to be forgotten. So they can write to Google and say, I want you to take me off. If someone searches, I want to be out of the searches. And there's recently been a follow-up search to say that doesn't apply just to European. It applies to anywhere you have a search. And so if that person is searched, they can't appear in your U.S. results, your African results, your European at all. Right to be forgotten, good thing, bad thing. Realistic thing, forget about it thing. How would you call it in a lightning round? I'm going to start at the end. Nuala.
Oh, gosh, this is hard to be short on this
one.
Be
in the middle.
I'm so sorry. Here, you go first.
Oh, that's it. Okay, Raquel, we're starting.
No, I'm not first yet.
We're starting with you.
All right. I open my big mouth, and there it goes. I was trying to give you time, Nuala, and then I just, screwed myself. But that's okay. Right thing or wrong thing? I mean, I think it's a right thing. I think that, I think this goes back to Nuala's point about the digital self. I think that if it's about me choosing, it's my right to be forgotten or my right to stay known and to be out there. I think that makes sense from a consumer perspective, and I think that makes sense from an individual perspective. Realistic in the U.S., to me it doesn't seem so realistic in the U.S., but, I mean, there's a lot of policies, and I think a lot of policies that European countries have that we just don't. And this is one of those where I think that in the right circumstances with the right stars aligned, it's something that maybe we could do in the U.S. But it would take some serious star alignment, in my opinion.
What do you think, Ryan?
Well, I totally agree. I mean, I think it's just it's interesting in principle, but it's in practice, I think, probably going to be almost impossible, but for two reasons. Number one is it'll just run right smack into the First Amendment a lot. You know what I mean? I mean, it's going to be a free speech problem. Your ability to withdraw from the internet is also my inability to talk about you in a certain way, right? So that's and Europe doesn't think about that quite as much. And then number two, I mean, we have an attorney here in the audience who worked for the Internet Archive, and there's something called the Wayback Machine that allows you to just go back and look at the version of the site from 5 years ago, from whatever, 6 months ago, and guess what's going to be there? The same thing you took down. You know what I mean? And so I just don't know how we do it.
Same ugly picture.
That same picture that you're like, I want this taken down. So I just don't know how we do it. I mean, I gotta agree with you.
And I don't know a lot about EU politics, but I know a lot about American politics. And the lobbying arm here, I don't know how you surmount that. I mean, to your point that you made, Jenny, about that first bill and all those lobbyists registering as you drop the bill in Olympia, that just seems...
my idealism has left me now, and this is the cynicism in me. I just don't know how we would be able to surpass that. But
well, so we always break down the EU-US debate as we are all about the First Amendment and free speech, and they're all about privacy. And it's not that simple. I want to really leave you with the thought that, first of all, I'm going to surprise you with my answer on right to be forgotten. Sorry to mess with you, Raquel, but we have a right to be forgotten in the United States. The Fair Credit Reporting Act, my favorite privacy law, actually allows for the deletion of your records after 7 years and 10 years and whatever. We've decided as a society that you have a right to be forgiven your sins in the financial context, but you also have a fundamental obligation to be known accurately and correctly for some period of time for credit decisions. That was premised on very, very good social policy foundations of equal access to credit, regardless of race, ethnicity, national origin, gender, et cetera. Your arrest records. If you're arrested as a minor, they are expunged, they are sealed, they are erased. You have that right to be forgotten. You see now the eraser laws, et cetera, et cetera. So we've decided as a country that in specific cases, public access to information in housing, we haven't even gotten to that, for fairness, for equality, for access to the market is essential to the social good. And in some cases, it is okay to be erased and to be, I'm very into the forgiveness thing. That's a very spiritual thing. But in Europe.
Did I mention she's Irish?
Yeah, Irish Catholic, so I'm going to bless you all. So anyway, but in Europe, the construct of the right to be forgotten, I worry has gone too far. I worry that the actual court holding, if you sit and read it once it's translated from the original Spanish, is actually far more measured than how it's being implemented. And how it's being implemented is that people with access to resources and money and lawyers are asking to have embarrassing stuff pulled down. And I would argue that if it's true about you and that it is something that happened to a public figure or in the public square or whatever, and it's relevant to the larger social good, like most historical facts are, we shouldn't be able to rewrite history. And that worries me. It worries me from a history standpoint, from an accuracy standpoint, from an opportunity to be known. I agree that we have some control over the digital self, and we have a whole other conversation on another panel about revenge porn and access to non-consensually shared. There's actually an acronym now in the policy world about non-consensual sexually explicit material. It's a really bad acronym, so I won't bore you with it. But about control of one's data and controls of one's image, very, very important. But being able to just say, I'm going to take that down because it was embarrassing and I'm really sorry I did it, especially if I'm a public figure or an elected official. Yeah. The first request to Google was some former member of the UK Parliament who had been caught in some financial scandal. I mean, that's important for the voters to know who they're going to reelect. So I would say, first of all, the dialogue and the debate is far more nuanced than either side gives the other side credit for. But that I have become, as I've said, and I'll leave on this note, from privacy, my privacy origins, my year and a half at CDT have made me go far over to the speech is what is under attack. Speech of the individual, of women online in particular, of speech against the government, that is what is the greater thing that is under attack in the internet today, and I worry greatly about it.
All right, we are going to take some questions from the audience, and we have a microphone over here so everyone can hear it. So if you have questions, line up there, and we'll take them one at a time. And if you could, maybe if you feel like introducing yourself, do. But if not, don't worry about it.
Oh, I'm Stinette Rose. And I'm very interested in the freedom of speech or the inhibiting of the freedom of speech that a lack of privacy provides. Recently, I was clicking very excitedly on some Bernie Sanders on Facebook, some statements he was making, and I was really interested in what I was reading, and the next thing I know, I had a pop-up invitation to the Communist Party. And I thought to myself, I'm actually building a political profile, and I need to wake up to the fact that I am doing that, and I need to be either an active participant in that, or I need to back away and reassess it completely. So any comments you have about the inhibition to freedom of speech that I think is happening due to a lack of privacy?
I think that's a very important question. And what I would say is that it's important to remember that there's a big difference between how you experience something and the potential that something will be used against you. And so in my own work, I differentiate between a subjective kind of privacy harm and an objective one. Where by subjective, I'm talking about the potential chilling effect. So for instance, I think it's fair to say that being able to Google things that are controversial about gender identity, about venereal diseases, about anything, being able to Google things and get an answer is probably less chilling than having to go to a librarian and ask for it, or have to go to your parents or asking one of your friends. You know what I mean? And this point has been made recently in a Brookings White Paper by Ben Wittes and his colleague, where he just talks about the fact that, like, people are not really good at figuring these trade-offs out. You know, I mean, so Google has a record of the fact that you search for these things, but you don't have to ask anybody, right? So you may be chilled less. On the other hand, there is the prospect that, unlike your friend who you go and asks a question to, or the librarian or the doctor, the company is in a position to leverage it and use it against you. And then there are some times where in using it against you or using it in a certain way, you come to be aware suddenly that you're subjectively aware of the fact that you're being tracked. And then you have both the subjective unease and the chilling, and also the objective potential material use against you. But I just think it's useful to talk about the difference between, you know, feeling like you're being surveilled and then the consequences of that. Because sometimes the worst thing is where you don't feel like you're being surveilled at all, but then it turns out things are being denied to you.
Question over here.
Hi, my name's Davidson. I'm on the faculty at the UW. My question is about privacy in the commercial sector and an issue that I don't think we touched on really, which is about the advertising model. So it's one thing that to have Zillow or Amazon collect data about me. They want to sell me stuff. But Google and Facebook and other social media sites are in the business of selling ads, so they're reselling that data. And I wondered what sorts of protections you think are necessary for guarding privacy of that kind of data.
Secondary use. I won't let the person on Zula have to answer that question. That would be wrong. Nuala, I'll let you do that.
Okay, so I think it's a great point, although I am so much more concerned about content and about, as Ryan just pointed out, the deprivation of access to opportunity. I think what the advertising industry is certainly moving towards is more transparency, more accountability, and the ability to choose not to be a part of that ecosystem should you want that. But what worries me is the example, for example, we looked at recently was a job search site where people navigating to that site were shown C-level, and I think it was actually a search for Seattle C-suite jobs, and they were shown to 88% men and 12% women based on their surfing history. So it wasn't just the ad, it was actually the opportunity. And as Ryan pointed out, the people surfing didn't even know that they weren't being shown something in the same, you know, category or at the same rate. And that was based on assumptions, and interestingly, anonymized assumptions or de-identified, not based on a knowing search based on a person's name, but simply they have come to this site from, let's be really gendered and you know, stereotypical, you know, a Sports Illustrated site for men or, you know, a fashion site for women or something like that. And that to me is the unintended disparate impact. You know, the algorithm wasn't set up for that. It was set up to show people looking for this city and this level job, you know, across the board. But the output was based on a kind of an advertising model or a cross-website tracking model, a very disparate impact. And so that worries me. Again, it's not only the data, but the decision being made about you and what you're not seeing.
Yeah, I probably would go a little bit further than that. I think there has to be some, I think there's some fundamental principles. People have a right to know what data is being collected, how it's being used by the entities collecting it, and who they're giving it to, so they can make the decision whether they want to continue in that transaction or not. And I think that if you give those three pieces and you really are able to do it, and right now the market, I don't believe, gives people adequate information about that. And there's a lot of arguments, and you hear it, well, people vote with their clicks. They're going to Facebook, they're going this. I don't think the majority of people truly understand what information is being collected, how it's being aggregated with other information. So I think it's a concern, but I think it's one that ultimately, I think that we will not solve it through legislation and regulation. I think we're going to have to solve it through marketplace and companies being more thoughtful. This side.
Hi, I'm Hans Goppel, and you may have just answered my question because I was thinking of the feasibility of something like your credit report, that you would be able to once a year find out what data has been collected from you and how it's been used, and then you would then, I think companies would be embarrassed sometimes to admit what they were collecting, which might cause them to back off, and people would then be aware of what was actually being done with everything that we did online.
Well, I think that's a good thing for people to stay. People up here know that the FTC and others has actually been talk at the federal level, either regulations or through powers they already have, of doing exactly that. Anyone who's a data collector would have to show individuals the information that they'd collected, almost like the Fair Credit Reporting Act, so you could see if it's accurate, and if it's not accurate, make sure it's corrected, and also know what's being collected on you. But that will only be happen if the market demands it. So,
I'm glad someone brought up the subject of government and corporate blurring. When it comes to young people, to me, a young person nowadays is anyone under the age of 25, and they're the biggest consumers. And corporations now sell products in such an intriguing way that kids don't even consider the thought, they're going to know about me. They're going to know everything about me. And I worry that someone mentioned that they think folks under the age of 25 are interested in privacy. They're really not. They're too interested in products. And you have to make sure that people under the age of 25, especially teenagers, start getting interested in data being collected on them.
So, I think it's an important point, and I don't want to be like, oh, that generation, you know, because it's not just that, you know, and I am over 25, but I will say, I mean, oftentimes as someone who has hired people who are in their mid-20s, I am fascinated at the things they think it's okay to put on the internet, that they choose to put on the internet, not data being collected, you know, against them, but what they choose to put on the internet. And I do think that they're, and I don't think this is a technology issue or a data issue or a privacy issue. I think it's like a young person issue. I think that when I was young, I was the same way, but it wasn't with technology and data, because technology and data wasn't where it is now. But young people just, they don't think about long-term consequences, period. And I think that's the case for every generation. All of us, you know, went through that moment where we realized that there are consequences to our actions and inactions. But I think that for this generation and generations to come, the problem is those consequences never leave, because it's on the internet and it's always going to be there and it's always going to be able to be found.
Well, another thing too is that products now are so intriguing, they're marketed in such a shameless sort of way that you don't even have time to think about how it's going to be impacting your privacy.
One trend that I worry about a lot is the trend from what we've been doing online up until about now, last few years, which is online preference marketing, where the idea is that you see ads on the basis of what companies believe your preferences are, right? And so the idea is that you're matched. Like if you like soccer, you see soccer ads. We gave a bunch of examples on this panel. The way it seems to be headed is a little bit more in the direction that this gentleman's alluding to, which is something called persuasion profiling. Persuasion profiling doesn't look at what you are interested in. It looks at how persuadable you are and what the best technique is to persuade you. Now let me just quickly say, this is science, right? I mean, so one example in a study was it turns out that some people are really worried about what other people think, and they want, you know, something that's really popular. And so for those people, you figure that out and you say, of the same product, our most popular item. But there are other people out there that they could care less what's popular. But for them, because of some way that they grew up or something like that, they really worry about scarcity. So the exact same product is advertised to that person by saying, while supplies last. The author of this study, one of the authors, is now on the data science team at Facebook. So that's the direction that these things are going, and I think it's something to keep a close eye on.
Sir.
Oh, I thought...
We'll switch over. Go ahead.
I'm Jennifer. I just graduated the other week from UW's.
We already knew that. And you shop... No.
From the interaction design program. And so a couple things came up that I wanted to kind of touch on. Nuala, you talked about like things having to start from the design side of things. And then Ryan, you talked about companies, like you have this sense that they're not working with a malintent. They're creating algorithms and products without thinking like, oh, this will discriminate against this group of people or whatever. But I think it's because of like where education is right now, particularly with UW. It's like we are in the art school, so it's a traditional studio-based curriculum where we don't really consider the things that we're doing as far as ethical and social implications, but we are producing things that are at a very fine, like, great craft, and that's what's been happening in Silicon Valley. So it's just like RISD pipelines to Facebook, Art Center's pipelining to Microsoft. All these studio-based curriculums are bringing designers into the tech world without like any sort of bearings of what we're actually working on. We don't have a sense of what the craft is, and I would say with a fair amount of confidence that this is happening too with the engineering side of things. And I did a 2-quarter-long kind of research thing about ethics in design education, and so I talked to a bunch of students at UW, Art Center, CCA in San Francisco, and RISD, and then I talked to some people at Berkeley, and all of these people who are doing engineering and design truly don't care about ethics, and I know that sounds kind of flippant, but it's true, and I don't know, so then what do we do to get behind all of this?
So, yes. I mean, I don't think it's okay that they don't care about ethics, but I don't think it's their job to care about the ethics, but that doesn't mean that company doesn't need to hire someone who does. Like, do you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, like, the UX designer, the engineer, you have a job. Develop code, you know, make sure the user experience is great and the UI, you know, works and it's perfect. But there needs to be someone at that company who is thinking about privacy and thinking about the ethics and thinking about those moral issues. And I don't necessarily know that it has to be the UX designer or the engineer. So I get your point. I mean, with regards to that, I do think that it doesn't, you know, I don't think it's in a vacuum, though. I think that a company is not just, you know, I am not an engineer or a UX designer, and I work at a tech company. So I think it's just about hiring.
But she does have morals.
I do have morals, and I have ethics, and so and I would weigh in on something like that, you know, at Zillow, and I think that there are other people, you know, Newell did the same thing at Amazon, and so it's not okay, but I think that it's not. It doesn't mean that the company or the organization is off the hook because of that.
And I think there's three good points you raise on that, and I know there's a long line, so we want to get to everybody, but one is, you know, I've been talking to a lot of the educators down, particularly in Silicon Valley, and I think instilling that sense of should we with the can we is going to be a change that has to be instilled in academia. But it's also, we talked about it at dinner, having in the companies themselves interdisciplinary teams. So the engineers are saying, hey, we got this really neat widget, we can do X, Y, and Z, and someone's like, that's just kind of creepy. We wanted to do X and Y, but not Z. Or should we do that? So I think making sure that you have that in the development stage. You're seeing the same thing around security. You know, technology way outstripped security, and people were building all sorts of intelligence that did not have security built in, and we're paying a heavy price for it. Sir.
I'm Alfred Klinger from Chicago. I'm from the president's neighborhood. Kind of like to look at the big picture. I'm wondering how damn efficient all of the internet and so forth, even though I must admit it has helped me. I mean, I could barely type when I got out of high school, and it's made me into a writer of type since I've learned how to use it. So I'm grateful for it. At the same time, with all of the communications it's supposed to be giving us and all the marvelous central intelligence and so-called intelligence, the hundreds of billions of dollars that we give to them, we still didn't know that the USSR was falling apart, that the Berlin Wall was coming down. We did not know how many tanks and strengths Hussein had when we invaded Iraq. We did not know how to get hold of bin Laden, and we sent thousands of troops and hundreds of and tens of billions of dollars per week to invade Iraq again. And I'm wondering, tell me, how efficient is the internet with all these marvelous intelligence agencies working in the government to give us the information we're supposed to know about so that we stop making wrong decisions. Please tell me.
I think the answer is we can never rely on the technology if the humans aren't good. And we've got to, you know, and the technology should never, sorry about your robots, they can't replace humans. And we're always, the bottom line is, it's only as good as the people making the decisions. But I think those are great points. Over here.
We have time for one last quick question.
All right. Uh-oh. Oh, wow. Sorry, folks. You're the last one.
Yeah. My name is Jacqueline Harani. I'm a rising 3L at NYU University. I am curious in this conversation, I found it very interesting, but I don't think really the dangers were talked about a lot. We're talking a lot about corporations and that they might use this information against us in some maybe surreal blackmail way, but I don't think that's the real risk. I think there's a lot of risks with tracking and with who can have access to that data. You know, like my family just got into the iPhone steps and how it can count every step that you're making. And the idea that my iPhone and everybody's iPhone in my family knows exactly where they are and whether they're moving or standing still seems something very serious and concerning. And additionally, the idea of, you know, using Google as a search engine, you were talking about that, you know, that is better than talking to the librarian or to your parents or friend or something, and isn't as harmful as it might seem. But when you're ending up in court and a court case comes up, whether you're in family court or you've been accused of raping someone and now your entire internet history is being scrutinized, or whether there's psychological studies that are coming up to determine, well, what hours are you searching this information or how many times did you search for that information? Was it really just an educational inquiry or an addiction or something? I think those are all serious risks. So if you have any comments on that? That wasn't short, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I apologize to the people who had questions and didn't get them answered. And if you want to grab some of us, I know some of us will stay around. But I think it's a really good question, and we didn't get into it, but one of the questions we didn't get to was personal safety. You know, that if you are, you know, particularly domestic violence victims or anyone, it's very hard to hide nowadays. And very easy to find people. And if you do find them, you can get, you know, the aerial surveillance of their house. You can sometimes get the actual plans to their house online. You can get, you know, incredible amounts of information about individuals. And I think we haven't quite reached that point. It was a very acute problem when I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office because we had a number of potential terrorist threats against critical infrastructure. And yet, because we are a transparent society, we had all, you know, online access to all of the emergency exits and tunnels for all of the public buildings in Seattle. And so there's always that weighing of balance. So I think you're absolutely right that there's built-in things that we really have to look at the individual cases.
So are you a 3L, like you're like a law student?
Yeah. I'll be starting my third year.
Awesome. So we'll
give you an internship if you stay.
Yes, I mean, after that thoughtful question, yeah, I talked to Emily. I think that as a privacy law nerd, I should tell you that there's this back and forth that happened early on in the days of privacy law literature between Dan Solov, who was one of the most influential privacy scholars around, and an equally interesting and really amazing scholar by the name of Ann Bartow. And Ann Bartow reviewed Dan's book. I believe it was probably Understanding Privacy, and she gave it a slightly negative review. And Anne said, look, you know, where are the dead bodies here? Like, you're talking about the digital person, and you're talking about this and that, but, like, you know, what about people's lives? Like, what about the, you know, the dead body? And I have to say that over the years working in this area, I feel like we're seeing more and more dead bodies. Some of the bodies are dead by their own hand because something that they did that was intimate was filmed and potentially shared, and so they killed themselves. And other people are dead because of drone strikes, and other people are dead because of other reasons. So, information is power. And sometimes that power gets abused and in violent ways. And so I appreciate your point very much. And I just recommend that back and forth between Anne and Dan as a student of privacy law.
All right, we're going to do one Last thought. Everyone gets to leave a thought. Nuala.
I'm fundamentally still the optimist on the panel, despite everything we've talked about. Your question was exactly right. We should be worried about the physical and the blurring of the lines between your online presence and your real life presence, and the risks that you're sharing and others sharing about you present. I am however, still despairing of Congress and frankly some of the interagency warfare. The Supreme Court's getting it right. I'm proud to say that CDT was quoted actually in several of the last major technology cases in the majority holding. But in analogizing, for example, in the Riley case, that your cell phone is the digital equivalent of dragging a footlocker around behind you with all your data and saying that that is beyond the scope of law enforcement intrusion for a search. In recognizing the tracking, the GPS tracking in Jones and others, that was far beyond not just law enforcement, but social norms and what is fair and what is right in the individual relationship space. I think we will try a lot of things and we will get them wrong in the corporate space, in the government space, but we will get to the right answer. And these are the rocky days where the platform is not laid, but we all are doing the right thing by engaging in the dialogue.
I think that final thought is any invention, any innovation can be used for good and it can be used for bad. And that we as a society have to make sure that we are not sleeping on when innovation and invention is being used for bad. And that's the same with technology. And again, I go back to, I think that the conversation around all the information and all the data being tracked and being aggregated, the level of the expectation is, I do think, is shifting in this country. And as it shifts, I think that's okay. I honestly do. But I think that there is still the checks and balances of making sure that it's not going to be used against you. The same way that the technology can be very efficient and can make sure that I don't get lost in Seattle, my new home, can also be used against me and can be a power that is abused. And we as a society just have to make sure that we are doing what we can as a democracy to stop that from happening.
Yeah, I mean, on a hopeful note, I think things have gone, in many people's views, too far, and now there's beginning to be a reaction and a course correction. I think you see that in the Supreme Court's recent jurisprudence, Riley, Patel, Jones. I mean, there's all these hopeful cases. There's some meaningful competition around privacy in the places that you might expect, like companies competing with one another to say that they're more private. Even among federal agencies, we're starting to see some competition in privacy, so that different agencies are getting into the mix and pushing each other a little bit in terms of what things to pursue and what fines to levy and so forth. So, I'm at one level very, very hopeful, but I think it's just sad that we had to get so far down that road before this reaction is finally starting to happen.
Yeah, and I'm with Nuala. I think it's optimistic, and I think looking in this room that you people came on this evening to talk about this shows it matters. And at the end of the day, I believe in our democracy, that it is the people who will decide and can decide if they have the information. Thank you for coming.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you could leave a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. The How Technology Impacts Civil Liberties event took place at Town Hall Seattle on July 14, 2015. It was sponsored by Town Hall and the Center for Democracy and Technology. Former U.S. Attorney Jenny Durkan moderated the panel. She was joined on stage by Nuala O'Connor, the president of the Center for Democracy and Technology, Raquel Russell, the Director of Government Relations and Public Affairs for Zillow, and Ryan Kalo, the Faculty Director of the University of Washington's Tech Policy Lab. Thanks again to Anna Tadashev for our recording. Tune in next week for another great talk. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.